Hi, today is February 19th, 2017. This is Mobile Views Podcast number 195. I'm Pat Agassa Ward, my good friend John Westfall. And today, some interesting development, something we wanted to do for a couple of years and finally got around to doing it. And that is moving my email from a web host, which hosted my website and one of my websites. And honestly, the website went down a couple of years ago because, let's see, what was I running first? Was it Joomla? No. It was Drupal. I was running Drupal. Mm-hmm. And it got compromised. I could not for the life of me restore it despite having backups. So I gave up on that, restarted using WordPress. WordPress got hacked a couple times. I was able to recover a couple times. The final one, it was just so bad, I shut down the site. I should note that I have another host. I'll name the host. So the one that I had problems with was HostGator. And it's not the host itself. It was, I think, the way WordPress was installed on it or whatever. Or MySQL, perhaps. But the other one, DreamHost, I've had a couple of problems with, PHP, MySQL hacks. But I was able to restore. But anyway, it's been about 2, maybe 3 years since my ogasawalrus.com site went down. Basically said under construction for the last 2 years. And I've been paying $140 a year for hosting. Because why would you host something you don't have up on a web? Because that's where a lot of my email was going. And I had a couple email accounts there. And you could say, well, why didn't you just switch to, Google premium email or Google Apps or something and bring over your domain name? And the answer to that is it's $5 a month mm-hmm. per account. And so if you bring two accounts over, it's $120 just for email. And you basically are paying the same thing I was already paying.
Yep.
I was relatively speaking, right? So, and plus the hassle and all that. So I just left it there. And I was paying, like I said, about $140 a year for email, essentially. And quite frankly, that's what you would pay for email if you go on most hosted exchange servers and things like that. So not a big deal. But I read about the Microsoft Outlook.com Premium going live. It had been in beta for a while, like many, many months. Went live a couple of weeks ago. And they have a special deal where if you create or subscribe to its service before the end of March, you get $20 a year. And I don't know if it's in perpetuity, but it does sound like it's a multi-year deal. And so I brought over my domain from HostGator. Let me rephrase. I didn't bring my domain from HostGator. I created an account yesterday or created a premium subscription for Outlook.com and, went into – and I hosted on Google Domains. Not hosted, sorry. I've got it registered through Google Domains. So I went to Google Domains and did all the MX and TXT record changes and all that. And as far as I can tell, I am receiving and able to send email from, my web-based Outlook.com using my custom domain name. So, and I brought over 2 email addresses. I can have up to 5. And also I can host up to, 5 people. So the difference is as a single entity, I can have up to 5 email address aliases, foobar1, foobar2, foobar3, etc. They all go to the same Microsoft Outlook.com account, however. So whether it's foobar1, foobar2, or foobar3, they all go to the same account. You can be a filters and stuff if you wanted to put in different folders, but it's a little different from having separate accounts. I'm okay with that. But what you can also do is invite up to 5 people. So, if you have a family, which is what it's designed for, your family members can have accounts and you still pay $20 a year, which is great. So, if you have 2 people, 3 or 4 accounts, at $5 a month per account on, Google and other places, you'd be paying $20 a month. So this is a good deal.
Mm-hmm.
The caveat is, however, although Outlook.com Premium lets you register your domain name through it, I recommend you don't. Because if you look through its FAQ, if you register a domain name through Outlook.com Premium, you cannot use that domain name with a website. It can only be used with your email. However, however, if you do what I did, and what I did was, you know, historical more than anything else. What I, you know, so as I mentioned, I have mine registered through Google Domains. If you have it registered externally, you know, through whoever, you can still have a website, still have custom domain email, and, you know, you pay marginally more. I think Google charges, I don't know, $12 or $13 a year to register a site. Microsoft charges about $10, in addition to the $20 a year, I think. But, you know, you can't create a website with it. So, and that's my advice to folks out there. If you want to use both a website and email addresses with your custom domain name, have it registered elsewhere, not with Microsoft, and then do an external. Now, having said that, the process to actually use an external registrar with Microsoft Outlook Premium is not that bad. Microsoft has a very nice wizard, you know, step-by-step wizard guide. Say, you know, do this first, do this next. Let me verify that. Let me make sure it's actually your domain, that sort of thing. It takes, I don't know, 15, 20, 30 minutes to step through it. And then the cutover, I think, was kind of instantaneous. And as soon as I could, I regret this in case it's not wasn't instantaneous, but so I sent in a cancellation to my web hosting site, a web hosting company. We'll see if I save, you know, $120 a year.
My advice is to go back in time to when Google Apps was free.
Ah, I remember
that. And sign up all of your domains on that. that is what I did the very end of Google Apps when it was finally when they basically said we're not going to do the free anymore. I actually signed it up when it was still at 50 users per domain. So that's what I've been using for my own personal email. And there's a few little issues with it. They did turn off the Exchange syncing a few years ago, which kind of annoyed me. I wish I could get that back without having to change my plan. I'm kind of hoping they forget about us and eventually just turn it on for everyone, forgetting about the grandfathered old Google Apps users. But if you don't have that, I've often thought about what would I do, and it would be somewhat of a chore to – I'd probably end up just taking my registrar, GoDaddy, does have email forwarding. I could do that and just forward to a regular Gmail account. I wish I could forward to my iCloud account and then send out under my custom from my iCloud account, but right. Apple does not allow custom from. No. So,
by the way, and just to save money, as I recall, GoDaddy is about $15 to $20 per domain. And that's without the, you know, privacy and whatever settings that they charge extra for. If you go to, and I, you know, this is not an advertisement of Google Domains, it's just kind of stating. Because I actually moved my domains from GoDaddy to Google Domains a number of years ago, maybe, you know, whenever they started, 2 or 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. And they're, you know, a bit cheaper, they're a couple dollars per domain cheaper. And some of the things that GoDaddy charges extra for is included.
You know. Yeah, I mean, really the only thing I'm using GoDaddy for is registrar, so I'm probably not going to say too much, but I might look into it. I have for a number of years had domains spread across different registrars, mm-hmm. and so GoDaddy was the first time I ever had everything under one registrar, which helped me a little bit.
Because but, I have, the time. That's what I did.
Yeah, I have no particular love for them or hate for them. So,
well, my problem with GoDaddy is every time I had to make a change, you know, sometimes I had to make a minor change. I remember when I wanted to – I have another podcast, as you know, called Comics Views, and I didn't want to create a new website for it, you know, or, you know, host or put an additional site under subsite on my host. So I created a Tumblr site, which in Tumblr allows custom domains for free, by the way. I wanted to point my, you know, my domain to my Tumblr URL, and so you could go to comicsviews.com and get there. And boy, I was a chore. Because GoDaddy has these really ridiculous user interface system that is difficult to navigate, and they try to sell you all kinds of stuff on the way there. And basically, that convinced me as soon as I could find a good, cheap registrar, I would switch. And that's what I did when Google Domains came up. But in any case, that's my advice to folks up there. If you want to, it's I think. I don't know. There might be cheaper domain registers, like cheap names or something like that, but...
Yeah, there definitely are. The GoDaddy interface, I'd say I haven't had too much trouble with it. It might have gotten a little bit cleaner since you used it, and they do try the upsells, but they're not as bad as the reigning upsell king, which I think is Network Solutions.
Oh my gosh, I used to have they were my first registrar. I think it was $35 or $40 a year. It was really expensive.
Yeah, I've always thought it was just amazing how much they try to upsell.
Yeah. Well, you know, can't fault them. They got to make money, but, you know, whereas Google doesn't have to make money, I guess. But right? They make all their money through ads, right? They don't make money through this stuff. This is just to get you on the internet and with them. And you know. Next item up is probably a short discussion. I don't have a lot to say about it, except it's interesting. Twilio.com's blog has a really interesting article about using Python with Google Spreadsheets. And, you know, as you know, I'm a Python fan. So I found that, and I wouldn't say Google Spreadsheets fan. I don't use it as much as Excel, I have to be honest. But, you know, if you do use Google Spreadsheets, and I do use it occasionally, especially when I have to share stuff with my daughter, for example, and you want to, you know, work with it programmatically, and, you know, if you know how to program in Python, a nice article, twilio.com/blog, and I'll post a link to it in our blog accompanying this podcast.
Yeah, I use Google Spreadsheets most often with Google Forms for quick fillable forms. And then I think I've mentioned it on the podcast, a way to sort of hack Google Spreadsheets and put in the URL SQL-like statements to just get certain columns and display them in a certain order. Mm. So I actually have one of my favorite all-time setups is a form that people put in events, then I go to the Google Spreadsheet, I approve them by just putting yes in the approval column, and then I have a URL linked off of one of my blogs that when you click on it, it shows you just certain columns in the order and only those that have yes in the approved column. Mm. So it's a really, really simple event submission approval queue sort of thing that you never have to update links or update a manual list. So yeah, you can do some really cool things with Google Spreadsheets. So the more that you can do, the Python stuff. There's also a script I've used for a few years that monitors websites using Google Sheets. That's pretty cool. So very happy to see Google Sheets get some love anytime I see that.
Yeah. And, you know, if anybody's wondering the reason why Python is in the early days of Google, a lot, if not most of their stuff is written in Python. I would guess most of it is written as Go now, or has been rewritten in Go, their own private language, kind of like Apple has Swift. But Google is, you know, part of their DNA. I mean, sorry, Python is part of Google's DNA. That's where much of the original Google came from.
Yeah, so,
good to see them still supporting it. Next up is more of a thing I wanted to ask you, you know, if you have any recollections, and that is in the early days of iPhone apps, and I say iPhone apps because in the early days there was no iPad. There are a number of software developers that were either consistently in the top 10 or he maybe had one hit wonder, but were really famous. You know, for example, I don't even remember the name of the company, but I remember the guy, Joel Comm. Joel Comm had the infamous fart app. That was a huge hit. I mean, it sold like, you know, tens of thousands of copies per day right after the iPhone gained the ability to get apps. And for those who don't remember, the first year of the iPhone, it had no apps. Everything was web-based.
Mm-hmm.
So there was, you know, the Fart app, and there was a great Koi Pond app. I remember interviewing their creators or my first podcast, I think. I have to go back and look. But one of the ones that really caught on and had multiple hits, you know, more than just a one-hit wonder, was Smule, S-M-U-L-E. And, in fact, I interviewed its CTO and co-founder, Ga Wang, twice in podcast number 34 and podcast number 55, because they had a number of really fun apps, and all based on musical instruments or singing and things like that. So... people might remember their, I think they had like a trombone app. And they had a piano app and a guitar app, but probably their most famous one for a long time was the IM T-Pain app, which, which you know, did the, oh gosh, what's it called when you, not a vocoder.
Auto-tuning.
Auto-tuning your voice, yeah. Which was, you know, really fun to use, I have to say. And I spoke to Gaw about that, and looking at date, September 2009, so quite a number of years ago. And then we spoke again in 2011, right after Smule bought Kush, K-H-U-S-H, which had the auto-tune type apps already of their own, which were kind of fun. And also some of the problems with music apps for Android, which was interesting. Turned out there was a problem with that. That's the audio API in Android, if you wanted to do real-time stuff. But at any rate, Smule just filed for an IPO, and I've got the link to the SEC here. And when I saw that news that, you know, they had, they were filing for an IPO, you know, they're still around, I began to wonder, whatever happened to some of the early successful iOS devs? I mean, you know, there are some that are maybe not early, but like the Angry Birds folks, Rovio, right? They're still around, but they don't have the kind of hit power they used to have when Angry Birds and some of the follow-ups were consistently in the top 10. I don't know. You have any memories of some early apps that really caught your attention, and then you wonder what happened to the developers?
I don't really have anything specific on that, but I do think what we saw happen in general was that when apps first came out, a lot of the software powerhouses out there and even the small little studios didn't really think there was going to be much of a market for them. There was a time back in 2008, 2009 that we thought web apps were going to be all there really was. You weren't going to go native anymore. In fact, I wrote a book with Rocco Augusto and another colleague, I forget, blanking on his name at this point. And it was on beginning Android web app development. And when we wrote that book in 2010, we were thinking that this is where things are going. You know, native was kind of it was Objective-C versus Java versus all these things. You thought, why can't I write in PHP, JavaScript, MySQL backends, you know, kind of have everything unified? That was before Swift was released, et cetera. And so I think what happened was the guys who got kind of rich and known for their apps early on were the ones that took the gamble and said, let's invest time. And as soon as they started investing time and making money, they either got snapped up by the bigger powerhouses or the powerhouses stepped in and said, you know what, we'll just start developing this area. And it became very hard for an independent software team of, you know, one or two people to actually pull off an app. So I think that's kind of what happened. There was a special period of time there where you were able to get in and do cool things because the big guys thought that it was a waste of time for them to do it. And now, unfortunately, it's very hard for a little guy to break in into the top 10 in any way.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting. I'm kind of looking through my podcast log and, you know, looking for things, people and companies to talk about. And some were just ahead of their time. For example, and this is before I started numbering podcasts, but the Mobile View, well, it used to be Mobile Views, Mobile Apps Today podcast back when I was a full-time blogger. But in December of 2008, so not quite 9 years ago, but 8.5 years ago or so, I interviewed Saul Lipman, who had a, whose little firm had a great great little app called 12seconds.tv. And while most people might not remember it, it was the predecessor of all these little apps that let you shoot video vignettes like Vine and that sort of thing that became pretty popular. Although I think Vine was recently shut down, not sure. But there was a time, not about a year or two ago, when these little mini, you know, 20, 30 second maximum video recording apps are super popular. And 12seconds.tv did exactly what it said. It let you record 12 seconds of video and post it up to their website. It wasn't YouTube-based or anything. You had to actually go through 12seconds.tv's site. And it was what I used it for was mini app reviews. So I would do like 3 screenshots, toss it into a video, do a voiceover, and in 12 seconds, you know, I could summarize what an app was and then write a blog around it. so people could see, you know, multiple screenshots, hear me talk about it a bit, and then read the article. So it was, I found it very handy, and I was kind of sad when they shut down the service and all of that. And another one, which is still a company that's still around, which you don't hear much about, is I think one of our mutual favorites. They came from the Windows CE world. That's Ilium Software,
mm-hmm.
which has, I still use, you know, one of their apps on iPhone. The folks that we knew there are gone by now, but I interviewed Ellen Craw and Mark Tassin,
mm-hmm.
who did some great work there. Back in, again, December 2008, and that was just a lot of fun, and I, you know, kind of wish that, the company's still around, but I kind of wish it was more active. Some other ones I'm looking at, Blimp Pilots, that's the name of the company that did Koipon for the iPhone, which is one of the most amazing early graphics items, and Joelcom's app was called iFart, as you might recall, and caused quite a controversy, made him quite a bit of money. It turns out I interviewed Gah for Smule much earlier. I had a third one with him in January 2009. We talked about Sonic Lighter, which was one of the first social music apps, probably the first social music app, where you can, you know, light up for various causes virtually.
Mm-hmm.
Interviewed Phil Libin, went back when he was at Evernote. Oh, Quick Office, which was bought by Google, you know, kind of like you said. So Quick Office was a nice mobile office suite bought by Google. Talked Griffin, the hardware company, they're still around. Paramount Digital, I assume Paramount's still around. They did some apps. I don't know if they do. They did an Iron Man app, if you might recall. Just kind of going through this stuff. Pangea Software, I don't even remember what they did.
They did things with computers.
Yeah. Bill Shrink, that was kind of interesting. It wasn't really an app as much as a service, trying to find, you know, better things. I know he went on to bigger and better things, but I just can't remember what. Reviewed Kyle Weens from iFixit. That was a lot of fun. I talked to Redfly. Do you remember Redfly?
I remember Redfly. I remember everyone else having Redflies and I being jealous that I did not have one.
Yeah. So back in May 2009, I spoke with Colin Kelly Jr. about Redfly. I had some complaints about it, actually. But it was kind of the predecessor to some of the things we see now with, I think AT&T, Motorola, or somebody had a phone that plugged into a terminal or notebook-like thing.
Mm-hmm.
That was.
I know the one you're talking about. It was actually something I secretly wished would have come out, that Apple would have done something like it, because it was kind of a cool idea. It was basically the phone that connected into the tablet,
right?
The tablet, and the tablet had a keyboard. So
right.
The true idea that you had one computing device that you used in whatever format you needed it in.
Right. So, you know, you kind of wonder. I mean, some of the companies like Ilium and stuff are still around, obviously. But others, you know, you just kind of wonder whatever really happened to them. And podcast number 32, August 2009, I interviewed the folks from Inrix, which probably are not really, I don't know if the app's still around, probably is, but it was the traffic forecast app back then.
Oh, yeah.
It's
still around, I think.
Yeah.
There's still some software that uses it.
Yeah.
You can even still download their original app, I think. It's pretty bare bones, but it'll give you some traffic data, et cetera.
Yeah.
I think they're still more around as a service versus a consumer app.
Well, I've forgotten all these people I interviewed. I talked to Chevrolet's accessories manager back in, I guess Chevy's still around. how about their mobile Wi-Fi solution? Oh, Nuance. Did Nuance get bought out? I can't remember now. Dragon Dictation for iPhone. AT&T Voice. I interviewed them twice. So, yeah, I just kind of wonder what happened. Like, I guess, like you said, a lot of them just got bought out. LiveScribe, are they still around?
No. Well, not in the same way that we thought about them. I mean, they're the ones that decided to ditch kind of their paper notebooks.
Oh, okay.
Which is really what they were known for, if I remember right.
Because, yeah, I had their Pulse Smart Pen, which had...
I had two or three of their pens.
Yeah, which had optical sensors, and you had to use a gridded sheet of paper to, you know, a special paper. I guess you could print it, too, if you had a good laser printer, to digitally record your handwritten notes. Didn't do OCR, although it could do search, which is kind of weird.
They are still around, but their latest version of pen, I do not believe. Well, maybe it does still need the actual paper. Mm. But I used that for a few years. I remember taking all of my Live Scribe stuff when I decided to stop using it and sending it to Judy Stanford in Texas of GearDiary.com.
Yeah, great website.
She got my leftover Live Scribes.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting. You know, we're talking about the small companies being absorbed by larger companies and larger companies kind of getting it and then entering the market by themselves. As we get further on into 2009, I notice I'm talking to some larger companies like Chevrolet. I spoke to AP about their AP Mobile Style book and why was it so expensive. So I talked with AP's VP Jane Seagrave back then. And in podcast 35, when actually this is after I started numbering, I guess, I talked to Stephen Gillette, who was at the time CIO for Starbucks. And so
you just talked to a lot of more interesting people than me. And then I took over and we're stuck with where we are now. So I see that I am probably personally responsible for the downfall of Mobile Views.
I hardly think so. But yeah, it was interesting to see, you know, who I was talking to back then and whatever happened to these products and these companies, which is what I'm more interested in. Like I hadn't really thought about Smule in a long time, so it's good to kind of think back and say, oh, that's what happened to these folks. Touch Studio from Microsoft, I think that morphed into something else. And FCC,
that guy,
yeah. Post Secret, I spoke to Frank Warren back in podcast 51. That was pretty interesting. Post Secret was always an interesting website, and they had an app. I think they had to take it off because of some privacy concerns. But it was an interesting idea, at least. You know, it was something worth pursuing. And I think that's when my podcasting slowed down. No, I did Unity, talked to Smule again. Sencha Touch, that was interesting. PBS Kids Augmented Reality app. So, yeah, I think you're right. It basically morphed into larger entities.
Yeah.
Taking off.
And then you got stuck with me. From much larger entities to me, who I am singularly a large entity, but not in the corporate sense. I just take up a lot of space.
Oh, here's one that's kind of sad. I think we talked about this one. Spring Partners. I spoke with Spring Partners CEO Jeff Janer back in December 2011. And as you might recall, John, I was a huge fan of SpringPad, which mm-hmm. was a web-based and iOS app that was kind of like, it had some overlap with Evernote. It's probably closer to what we now call what Google Keep looks like. But I thought it was a much simpler program than Evernote, which is why I liked it. But I also liked it because SpringPad had a unique feature of having a store of data. So, for example, it had a database of almost every movie and TV show that you could draw upon for your notes. You know, if you just wanted to refer to a TV show or something in your notes.
Mm-hmm.
It also had, I think, a recipe, an ingredient database that you could draw upon, you know, into your notes. So you wouldn't even have to type stuff. You would just, you know, grab it from their library and shove it into your notes. So, and a bunch of other data like that, which I thought was really interesting. It was very sad when that service was shut off a number of years ago. It was a good one. Yeah. Any other big iOS app devs that you kind of wonder whatever happened to them?
Not really.
Really?
I mean, it's a fast-paced world.
Yeah.
The only way that you stay around is if you're like my consulting company and you just never do that much work anyway and no one bothers to buy you. I mean, it's become a point of pride that I can say that my consulting company has been in operation since 1998, but we don't actually do that much. So even though we'll be celebrating our 20th anniversary, next year. We're not actually, we're probably celebrating it this year because I think bugjr.com went online in 97. So yeah, just don't do much and no one will ever want to buy you or absorb you in any way, and then you can stick around. You can be a little guy perpetually if you'd like to be.
Well, but you know, that's an interesting point because sometimes companies try to grow too fast. I'm thinking Krispy Kreme. And what is it, Boston Chicken, a couple others like that, and they just expanded too fast, couldn't really maintain their pace or their sites, and basically had to start downsizing.
Yeah, I'm not doing that with Bug Jr. at all. It's not moving fast at all. In fact, I look at the website right now, and the picture I have on it is from the Windows 7 launch. So I haven't even really updated that in a long time.
All right. And speaking of you, you've got a couple items on the blog rundown here.
Yeah, the first I will mention, and I'll give a shout out to my friend Michael Kaler, who mentioned this to me this morning when I saw him, that there's this rather interesting problem that Microsoft's having where Patch Tuesday has been indefinitely put on hold till probably sometime in March, which is for IT guys a little bit concerning. Yep. It's very concerning now that Google has gone ahead and released a couple of basically 1 0-day exploit for server message block. So it's something that there's no fix for at this moment. And it makes me just sort of reflect, not just on this specific issue, but the sort of security world we live in, where occasionally you'll find out about an iOS security breach and then Apple gets a patch out within a couple of days or a week. And that's sort of what we're used to. This whole idea that Microsoft is holding off because they can't do cumulative roll-ups or they're having some issue with that, that is somewhat disconcerting. And from an IT perspective, very troubling.
You know, I don't understand this at all. Because if it's Google that, you know, provided the information, they usually give a significant, I don't know what it is, 60 or 90 day warning before they publicize something.
Yeah, but this is the second time they've sort of publicized something very quickly. And by very quickly, they sort of, I think, give probably a week or two. It's just not the 60 or 90 day. And, you know, quite honestly, in today's security climate, I don't think you can afford to wait 60 or 90 days anymore.
Except unless you're Microsoft.
Unless you're Microsoft. But we know that the only way to really get action is to have it out in the wild and people know it exists. And then all of a sudden, companies like Microsoft and Apple are kind of forced, their hand is forced.
Right.
And I hate to say it, but sometimes I think they need to have their hand forced.
Right, or have their behind kicked.
Yeah, a little bit of both.
The other thing I don't understand is, presumably there are other patches that were supposed to come out that day. Why didn't they just release those patches? You know.
Yeah, I suspect that Microsoft has long had the ire of the IT world because, as you know, and I know, that when you install Windows, especially the older versions of Windows, and you immediately power them on, there's 7,000 updates or something like that.
Oh, it doesn't have to be an older version of Windows.
Yeah.
I recently bought a brand new PC, as you know. I think we spoke about it a podcast or two ago, to replace a broken 2008 PC. So I guess that shouldn't need to be. Anyway, brand new PC running Windows 10. Not sure it had Anniversary Edition on it. Probably did. But it was updating for like 4 hours after I cracked open the box and plugged it in and basically turned it on and said update.
Mm-hmm.
It was crazy.
It's definitely something that there's a real problem that I hope Microsoft addresses and others address, that you need to be able to do cumulative kind of on-the-fly updates. So package them all together for a particular machine and ship them down in one batch, and you need to do it reliably.
Yeah, and I guess although Chromebooks aren't taking over the world, you can see why entities with perhaps limited IT resources like schools are attracted to something that needs minimal maintenance from an update point of view.
Very true.
Yeah. And speaking of Chromebook, I still can't get one because Amazon is not shipping anything with a battery or the lithium-ion battery, including emergency lamps, by the way. I tried to buy a lantern with lithium-ion rechargeable batteries, because we've been having a lot of blackouts here in the third world nation of Honolulu. And we've had like five in the last 2 weeks. and they just wouldn't ship it to Hawaii. So I bought one that uses D-cells, which is fine. I mean, you know, I think a little less environmentally friendly, but there you go.
Oh, your continued plight of living in paradise.
Right. Oh, also, you know, the Samsung Chromebook Plus, which is the other one I was looking at now that I can't get an Acer. The Google Chromebook Plus was supposed to go on sale last week, and I see bloggers who've gotten, I guess, pre-release versions reviewing it. But if you go to Google's Chromebook store, you cannot order one. It still says coming soon. So that's kind of irritating. I was hoping they could ship one to Hawaii safely, you know, without catching fire. Any rate, you have something else on the rundown I'm looking at.
Yeah, so I've had a few issues with my 2015 MacBook Pro, and I mentioned this, I think, at some point on the podcast. Basically, it didn't like booting up with File Vault enabled. It would boot up. It would take a while to boot up, and then when it finally got to the login screen, the mouse wouldn't move or it would move very jerky. You couldn't log in, etc., and I'd have to do system or SMC resets and PRAM resets and all these other things to try to even get it to let me log in. Yikes. So about 3 weeks ago, I wiped it and restored from Time Machine Backup, which was actually a fairly delightful experience. It took a while, but it worked pretty well, except whatever the problem was, it brought it over with the backup. So even though the backup took me from a clean wiped hard drive back to my desktop in less than a day,
right?
It still had the issue. So this week I decided to just do a complete reinstall, downloaded Disk Maker X, and basically created a boot disk off of a USB drive, booted it into the Sierra installer, did all that, got up and running, and it amazes me what Apple brings down from iCloud and what it does not. So I didn't restore any sort of backup to this. All I did was install the basically just log in with my iCloud account. And a few things came down. So, for example, my account information for my different mail accounts, but not the passwords, which I thought was weird because iCloud Keychain came down. So I would think that'd be something that would get stored into iCloud Keychain. And things like in mail, my signatures came down from iCloud, but they weren't linked up to the mail accounts. So I had to actually go in and link them up, which is a really bizarre sort of thing. Like, why would the signatures come down but not the actual linking to the accounts that they were used for?
Yeah.
And I think it's just interesting that Apple has a lot of information about your Mac stored in iCloud for the very purpose of making it a very seamless experience when you log into a new Mac or install Mac OS on a new machine or buy a new Mac. But it's like there are little gaps and little holes that are still missing for whatever reason.
Well, at least it wasn't, you know, 100% some scratch, which is how I usually install, like, Windows. Windows doesn't require, well, I guess that's not true anymore. Windows 10, you have to log in with a live account, so, or a Microsoft account, so it knows a few things, I suppose.
It knows somewhat how to be sneaky and know you went somewhere.
Now, refresh my memory. I think I've used Disk Maker X before. Is that the one where you begin the install, you download from the Mac OS App Store, but instead of typing or instead of hitting the install button, you just stop at that point. Leave the install button there. Don't touch it. And then use Disk Maker X to create a bootable USB drive. Is that the one?
Yep. And so I have, I did that for, actually, I found I still had the El Capitan installer on my MacBook. I never deleted it. So I created an El Cap boot disk, and I also created a Sierra boot disk. So they're just kind of nice to have around. And they also are nice if you ever have to boot a dead Mac or a problematic Mac. You've got that. Even though you can boot into, you know, recovery over the internet and things like that, it's just a good tool to have.
Yeah, which is a good reminder for me because I don't think I've built one for whatever it is I'm running on this MacBook Pro. And it is not the latest because it's too old to run the latest. Definitely something's probably running El Capitan or something. Okay, well, that's about all I have, especially now that I've developed hiccups for some reason. Nothing else to add? You got anything, John?
I have nothing else other than just to say happy February, since it's February 19th. I don't know if we've wished a happy month to anyone.
No, so we there, haven't, but it's a good it's a good thought. Oh, I didn't have my useless fact of the week. I'll come up with one for next week.
Three Musketeer bars used to come in two different or three different flavors. Strawberry, vanilla, and chocolate. There's John's useless fact of the week.
A good tip. I wonder if it's still there. But anyway, we will talk to you next time.